Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Anthony Shelley, the court-appointed amicus here on behalf of the appellants. This appeal raises two issues. Did the district court have subject matter jurisdiction, first? And second, did the district court commit error when it granted summary judgment to the appellees based on the statute of limitations? On the first issue, the district court lacked jurisdiction. Therefore, the case should be remanded to the Superior Court. On the second issue, even if you accept the facts as the district court found them and assume them to be true, this case, the claim did not begin to accrue until 2003, making this case timely filed in 2005. I'd like to go in reverse order and actually begin with the statute of limitations issue, since so much energy has already been devoted in the briefs to jurisdiction. The district court held that there were no genuine factual disputes as to whether the case was timely brought and therefore awarded summary judgment. I think at the start it's useful to summarize the nub of the claim actually raised by the appellants. The claim was that Mrs. Hancock, a 78-year-old financially unsophisticated widow, entered a mortgage transaction, but that the transaction was fraught with all sorts of illegality, from forgery to lack of proper disclosures to fraud regarding the settlement associated with the loan. As a result of these illegalities, the Hancocks, her children, and executors of her estate alleged that the appellees should not be permitted to foreclose on the property that had since the loan had since gone into default. They also seek various damages associated with the illegality, though not specified in the complaint. So because there was a summary judgment in the case, the question is whether, as a matter of undisputed fact, Mrs. Hancock knew or should have known of the illegality associated with the transaction essentially before she died in 1997, or whether her children, the Hancocks, should have known about the illegalities before 2002, since the case was filed in 2005. It's one of the most fact-laden inquiries a trial court can do, the statute of limitations, basically who knew what and when. Obviously, the parties have a difference of opinion on the facts, and we can get into that, but even if you accept the facts as Judge Friedman found them, I think the claim did not accrue until 2003. These are the facts we know about Mrs. Hancock. We know she entered a loan because she was making payments on the loan. So that happened in 1994. She had seen a version of the deed that was unnotarized because we know that was found in a trunk in 2003 among her papers. We also know that she saw a version of the adjustable rate note that was not witnessed, based again on what was found in her trunk. That's all we know that she saw.
We know she got a package, right, in 1994 as well?
We know that she received some sort of package from a courier because her son, I recall her son handled it. It could be this package that has these documents in it, the documents that were found in the trunk, because it was a package that was found in the trunk. And in there was an unnotarized deed of trust and the adjustable rate mortgage, but it was unwitnessed. It wasn't the final version. None of those things suggest illegality. There's no suggestion that those documents were forged. There's no suggestion. You can't tell from those that a settlement occurred without Mrs. Hancock being present somewhere in Baltimore. Judge Friedman did say that the deed of trust indicated that the settlement occurred in Baltimore. But in fact, if you look at the deed of trust, which is in the appendix, the deed of trust, even the notarized version, this one was unnotarized, doesn't have a place of settlement stated on it. All it does is has a Baltimore notary on it, but that version, even with the Baltimore notary, wasn't what was found in the trunk.
And your alleged illegality is?
Several things. Lack of disclosures associated with the transaction. The settlement was illegal because it occurred without her being present. It occurred somewhere in Baltimore, and in fact she was not there, and all the documents were forged, and therefore this transaction, which I believe she intended to enter a loan, but it was a forgery that occurred here, and she may have never entered this transaction had she known that she was dealing with people who would fake a settlement, forge documents, fail to give her disclosure, and frankly, it wasn't a good deal she entered.
That's why they stopped paying in about 2000, right?
Well, I believe it was a little later that they stopped paying, but I believe the children both went bankrupt.
She paid for a number of years.
She paid until her death, actually, until 1997.
And the reason I mention that is because if they stopped paying in 2000 or around there because of concerns about the loan, that would certainly support Judge Friedman's conclusion about inquiry notice as of 1999.
I don't believe they stopped paying because of concerns about the loan. I believe they can they stopped paying, or at least a jury could conclude they stopped paying because they couldn't financially afford the loan. But it wasn't until 2003 then to get to what the Hancocks know. The Hancocks
and just ask you, as I understood the district court, it found that one, the mother would have known whether or not there was prior disclosure. And secondly, would have noticed that there were two payments that presumably she did not authorize. What's your response?
I think the district court did hold that, but I don't think it's possible for her to have known that, unless she saw what's known as the HUD-1 form.
Right.
The HUD-1 would have shown the payments, but there's no indication in the record that she saw the HUD-1. The only thing we know for sure she saw was what was in her file and found in the trunk, which included the deed and the adjustable rate mortgage. There's the HUD-1 was obtained by the Hancocks, according to Judge Friedman in 1999, but the Hancocks dispute that. They say that. In their summary judgment papers below, that they did not obtain it until later on. A specific date isn't given. What the Hancocks saw in 1999, the children saw, was the documents that were officially on file in the District of Columbia. So the deed, the adjustable rate mortgage, and some other documents. And at that point, though, they had no reason to think there was a forgery because these were the ones on file with the District of Columbia. It was in 2003 that they then found the additional documents that were Mrs. Hancock's.
Well, let's see. In 99, they would have noticed that a closing took place in Baltimore.
If they had seen the HUD-1 in 1999, and I think we can, the Hancock's say they didn't see the HUD-1, because the HUD-1.
The district court, though, found that they saw the HUD-1.
The district court said, the way the district court found the facts, the district court did say that the HUD-1 was found in 1990, was obtained by them in 1999 from District of Columbia authorities, but that's not the Hancock's position, but it doesn't matter anyway. Because the HUD-1 does say a settlement occurred in Maryland, and then there's a notary, a Baltimore notary, on other documents that says Maryland, although I don't think an average person would think that simply a notary being registered in Baltimore means everything occurred in Baltimore. But the Hancocks, it did give them pause. There's no question it gave them pause whenever they did see this document that said the settlement occurred in Baltimore, because their mother didn't traditionally travel on her own. But the mother also didn't tell them much about the mortgage in this case. So conceivably, in 1999, a jury could find, well, the mother wasn't telling them about the mortgage. Maybe she did have somebody take her over to a settlement in Baltimore, and the transaction was a legitimate one. I think a reasonable jury could find that. Judge Friedman didn't have a basis for saying there would be no material dispute as to that issue. It was only in 2003 when the Hancock children found the new the documents that were in the trunk that they then said, something's wrong here. This deed of trust doesn't look like that deed of trust that we got. This adjustable rate mortgage doesn't look like that adjustable rate mortgage that we got from the district. And it's then that they got an attorney. It's then that they did a handwriting analysis, and the handwriting analyzer found that there was a forgery. The documents that were filed with the district were forged, and that Mrs. Hancock didn't sign those. And it was at that point that they brought their lawsuit.
Lots of questions, or at least questions and concerns before 2003. These concerns didn't spring up from nowhere in 2003, at least as I read the record.
They didn't amount to if the Hancocks, I think what the district court suggested was the Hancock children should have brought a lawsuit after 1999. The only thing they knew in 1999 was that what seemed to be legitimate documents were on file with the District of Columbia with the proper formalities and disclosures. And their mother entered a loan that I assume they wished that she hadn't entered, and that she apparently went somewhere to Baltimore to do this without telling them. I don't know what kind of claim they would have had at that point. If they were to bring a claim at that point for forgery, no basis for it. For conversion, no basis for that. For fraud of some type, no basis for that. It wasn't until 2003 that they found additional documents that look different from the documents that were on file with the district.
When they refused to pay in 1999, what did they say?
In refusing to pay? I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
What is there in the record on that? Anything?
Well, I believe they refused to pay because of the, because
no,
of...
What is on the, in the record?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't have it at my fingertips on that point.
But there were, in other words, it could not have, wasn't Judge Friedman entitled to conclude that if they refused to pay in 99, they concluded there was something wrong with the loan?
I think he was entitled to, one party could conclude that, another party could conclude that they couldn't afford the loan, and that's why they weren't making the payments on it.
And that is in the record. I mean, the daughter had a temporary job, had trouble when the son was disabled.
And they both ultimately filed for bankruptcy.
Right. Repeatedly.
I think that whether this claim will survive on the merits and whether recovery will be made is one question, but I think the only question here is whether... whether the parties, whether the Hancock children or Mrs. Hancock, had the type of knowledge necessary to trigger a lawsuit. And I don't think they had that, given the facts that existed and that were in dispute on the record. And so our position on the statute of limitations is that a reasonable jury could have found that this claim didn't accrue until 2003. The inquiry notice accrued in 2003. They brought the lawsuit within two years after that. Everyone agrees that 3 years is a statute of limitations. The Goldman case only adds further to this. The Goldman case tells us that in a situation like this where you have financially unsophisticated individuals who may be being taken advantage of, you have to put yourself in the shoes of those individuals to see how would they react to this situation. It's not what a reasonable person would have thought in this case, but you have to take their circumstances, and that's a decision of this court here. The district court never went into that. The district court, frankly, as you read through it, you get the sense the district court resolved all benefits of the doubt against Mrs. Hancock and her children when Goldman says it should be exactly the opposite.
Do you want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, I would. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Scott Calkins and I represent the Appalachian Bank of New York and Wachovia Equity Servicing LLC, formerly known as HomeX Servicing Corporation. I'll refer to Wachovia as HomeX since that's how it was referred to in the record below and in the briefing. I'm here to address the jurisdiction issue. Mr. Mitchell will address the other issues on the appeal. In respect to diversity jurisdiction, and the notice of removal was removed both based upon diversity of citizenship and federal question jurisdiction. With respect to the diversity of citizenship, the only issue that I understand the Hancocks have really raised is a question about the way the notice of removal was pleaded as to the defendant, Barry Blank, who was a resident of the state of Maryland at the time of the removal.
So I realize you've split up this oral argument, but appellant just focused on the statute of limitations question, which seems to me the stronger of his two arguments. I wonder whether we should take an awful lot of time on the jurisdictional question.
Your Honor, I'm fine not to do that. What I would like to do is...
Perhaps you ought to reverse your order and let my colleagues would agree with it and have your other counsel come up and talk about the statute of limitations. And if we have any questions on jurisdiction, we can come back.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I'd be happy to.
May it please the court. I'm Bill Mitchell, and I'm here on behalf of Valley Title and Barry Blank. The district court's analysis of the statute of limitations issues was correct. And I want to back up a little bit and start with, I think, the logical starting point, and that is what Carolyn Hancock knew or reasonably should have known about the circumstances of the loan. There's no dispute in the record, and I think appellant's counsel indicated this during his statement. Carolyn Hancock intended to take out a loan, and she did. The documents, we know, were delivered to her. Documents were delivered to her in December of 1994. We know that payments from her on this loan began in November of 1994 and continued until her death. We know that she instructed her children to assist her in making at least one payment prior to her death on this particular loan. And we know that her children, for a period of time after her death, paid the loan, albeit increasingly more sporadically. A question that was put by the court to appellant's counsel concerned the reasons why payments on the loan ceased by the appellants. And in our motion for summary judgment and our undisputed statements of fact, it's in the record at A104, there's a statement that plaintiffs continued to pay the loan from March 1997 until approximately 2000, although the payments became more sporadic throughout that period. The payments ceased when they had sufficient information to support their belief that the loan was invalid and had been obtained under questionable circumstances.
Well, I looked at the record sites that you gave in your brief for that statement, and the record sites do support the proposition that they stopped making payments sometime in 2000. But I don't see where the record sites that you give support the statement that at the time they believed they possessed sufficient information and knowledge to support their belief that the loan was invalid and had been obtained under questionable circumstances. The two pages you cite in your brief don't say that.
Well, Your Honor, during Ms. Hancock's deposition, there were quite a litany of questions, and that's in the record.
Right, and she says stop paying sometime in 2000.
Right.
I agree, but it's the rest of the sentence that's critical here, and I don't see that in the record.
And in her deposition, there's a statement from her, I believe, and I can find it and cite the court to it.
Your brief cited Appendix 104 and Appendix 145.
Yes, Your Honor. And that may, in fact, have been an error in terms of the pinpoint site.
This was in your statement of undisputed facts in your motion for summary judgment.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Was this statement disputed?
No, Your Honor. In the response, the opposition, there's a separate response of the plaintiffs to the statement of undisputed facts, and it goes to 23, which is the critical one. It's denied in terms of the characterization continued to pay the loan is inaccurate, as plaintiffs repeatedly went into default.
Go more slowly, counsel. I can barely hear you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Nerves. In their response, the appellants say the characterization continued to pay the loan in statement number 23 is inaccurate, as the plaintiffs repeatedly went into default or for other reasons failed to pay the loan from 1998 onward.
Are you on A425? Is that where you are?
Actually, Your Honor, I am actually reading from A397.
Okay. Well.
And directing.
Right, but what is the statement? I look, what you cited in your brief were the two pages I just mentioned, plus 396 and 97. All right, and that's their response. Now, what is your statement of undisputed fact that supports what is at the top of your brief in 48, the last part of that indented sentence?
Your Honor, I think if A171 and 172 should have been the correct site there, and I apologize to the court. There, it's an excerpt from Ms. Hancock's deposition concerning concerns that she had about the loan. And basically there, it gets to the nub of the issue. There were concerns throughout the process. When you combine their testimony along with what we know about their mother and what she knew and what the court found.
Doesn't know the details, the mother didn't tell her, and then she said I had questions, but you have to have substance. And when I got the papers in 2003, I saw that there was a difference.
Right.
I still don't see the record cites or support of this statement in your brief.
Your Honor, at the bottom of 172, there's a question. Did you share your concerns with your counsel, your bankruptcy counsel, in 1999? And those would be the concerns she referenced earlier about the loan.
What concerns are those, counsel?
The concerns that they had found documents in the land.
I had concerns, but I had no evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. The deposition testimony was that they had gotten documents pertaining to the loan from the land records.
And they got the officially filed documents from the recorder of deeds.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there was nothing there other than the fact the notary was licensed in Maryland and that their mother may have gone to Maryland and not told them about it.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, what was there from those documents that would have put them on notice that this was a potentially fraudulent deal?
Well, with respect, I think if you look at the district court's opinion and its analysis of the facts in the record that were presented to it, if
right.
you take it all the way through, there's a chain of facts I did not mean to interrupt, Your Honor.
No, but what I'm getting at is this is summary judgment, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's de novo review.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, and the district court's opinion doesn't help me in this regard. And that's why I thought your brief was going to help me. And when I got to page 48 of your brief, I saw this statement, and I thought, well, that's the case. But then when I tried to find some record support for that statement, the pages you cited in your brief do not provide that support. And right now, just reading quickly, 170 and 171, and you said 172, I don't see it there either. I mean, maybe if you have something more specific, you can provide.
Well, can you look at A425 and tell me so you can unpack that for me?
I will be happy to do that,
Number
Judge
25. Gavin.
A425,
which is cited in your brief on the page 47 of your brief, and I looked at this A425.
Yes, Your Honor.
Number 25.
Yes.
So upon reviewing the documents, both became troubled and had concerns about the loan. There are a bunch of sites admitted.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's one of the sites that I was trying to reach for, and I just wasn't able to reach for it. And my apologies to the court.
And what are these concerns?
The concerns, if I could, Your Honor.
In other words, what I'm trying to distinguish between is this. Is once they got the official records, they may have looked at the deal and decided their mother entered a bad deal. But that's not evidence of any fraud or any basis.
No, Your Honor.
What is the indication here that they had some indication of fraud?
Your Honor, I think it's, and I'm not trying to be circumspect, I'm trying to be as straightforward as I can and be helpful to the court. I think it's a combination of the fact that their mother's circumstances during this time period when this loan was taken out were such that she did not drive, and the documents they got in 1999 reflected at least some evidence that there'd been a transaction involving Maryland. And that's something that she would not have done. And I think the district court's...
Well, the daughter testified that, their mother would take taxis.
She did.
I mean, there were times that they didn't know where she was. So I don't think that gets you where you need to go.
Counsel, I'm a little confused about my question before. Were you suggesting earlier that in your statement of undisputed facts, counsel for plaintiff did not dispute your assertion, whether or not there is record evidence for that assertion?
I don't believe I was going that far, Your Honor.
Hypothetically, if this were true, if you made a statement of undisputed facts, and if it was not disputed, the district judge was entitled to grant summary judgment, even if the statement of undisputed facts was an error.
I agree with that, Your Honor. My point was that the statement of fact was made. We believe there was support in the record for
it. No, but wait a minute. Did you make a clear statement of fact
that was not disputed?
Yes, Your Honor, that's our position.
Where did you make that? That's what we're searching for.
Well, that's the number 23 in our motion for summary judgment, that their response doesn't dispute.
Wait, and what is number 23?
That was the stopping that when the payments ceased because of concerns about the loan.
Yeah, but concerns about the loan, that I agree is in the record. But what concerns? I mean, where is the evidence of fraud? Maybe they were concerned about the loan because the monthly payments were too much for them to pay, and they kept going into bankruptcy so they wouldn't lose the house. But what I need is, and what I thought you were getting at, and I thought what Judge Silverman was getting at, is did you say, moving for summary judgment, that it was undisputed that the children, as of '99, had evidence of fraud or had all the evidence they needed to bring a cause of action, as they subsequently
did? Yes, Your Honor.
And where is that?
And that is, Your Honor, that starts at the beginning with what their mother knew. They brought
Where is it in your statement of material facts?
Can I ask you, I don't want to interrupt the question,
no,
but A425 again, I was looking at, and tell me if this is wrong, and number 28 says they were again, at the bottom of the page, they were again concerned about the proprieties of the loan documents. This is now in 2003. And I assume that means that the previous concerns were about the proprieties of the loan documents.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is this the best place to look?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it probably is. And I will point out that these are HOMEC and Bank of New York's statement of undisputed facts.
It's a response of the plaintiffs to defendant's statement of undisputed facts, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then it's admitted.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And the statement, it references deposition testimony that was attached to the motion for summary judgment that was before the court, in which the court clearly considered when it reached its decision.
It would have been helpful if it specified, as Judge Rogers asked, what the concerns were in 1999.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. And I think, though, that the way that it was phrased was based on the testimony in the deposition about concerns. And I guess that goes to, as I understand the issue, the nub of it, whether we have sufficient evidence of wrongdoing.
The testimony was there were concerns, but they didn't have any evidence. That's what I'm trying to get at, counsel.
Yes, but in our position is they did.
Well,
they
what
had,
was the evidence they had?
They had the evidence of, they clearly knew that the loan was there. Let's start from that there was a loan. They paid it. They made inquiries with the servicer after their mother's death concerning the circumstances of it. Apparently, they were not satisfied with those responses because they continued to investigate, as they testified. They got the documents from the land records in 1999. They then realized it references some connection to Maryland, which they see, as they said in their complaint, an unlikely location due to their mother's lack of driving and the fact that if she needed errands run, while they didn't, were not able to account for every second of every minute of her time during that period, they did testify that if she needed some special trip or something, one of, I think Mr. Hancock typically drove her.
The children had gone to a lawyer and said, we got this deed and some other documents that from the recorder's office, and it shows that the closing was in Maryland, and our mother didn't tell us she was going to Maryland. We didn't take her to Maryland. It's unlikely. We think that she would have gone to Maryland. Laura says, I'll file a fraud case tomorrow. I mean, what is there that, at that point, that gives them any indication other than that their mother was secretive about her financial affairs and they have slipped off to Baltimore to do the deal?
Your Honor, I think what they gathered from the land records along with what they previously knew is enough to trigger the period to run and put them on inquiry notice.
What they knew, counsel. They had the official record.
Yes.
And they knew that their mother couldn't drive.
Yes.
And normally she would tell them where she was going.
Yes.
But that they admitted in the deposition that she took taxis and they didn't always know where she was. What else did they know? This is summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is your your burden to show that you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think that those facts taken together along with the circumstances, the court's consideration of everyone's particular circumstances, the evidence that came from the plaintiffs,
the children had come to you and you weren't associated with any of the defendants in this case in any manner, would you have filed a lawsuit based on that, charging these defendants with fraud?
In 1999? No, ma'am.
Wasn't enough evidence of fraud at that point.
But I do believe that there were sufficient circumstances to trigger the duty to inquire further.
And that's my hypothetical. They go to an attorney and they say, we've got this information. What's next?
The attorney investigates it and determines whether there's additional information.
And what's he going to find out in 99?
Well, Your Honor, in 1999, there's the information concerning who the servicer is to obtain all the documents. There's information concerning who did the closing, the notary's name, other avenues to explore the identity of the people participating in the transaction.
You could have learned everything in 1999. You learned in 2003.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe so.
So the point is, under the discovery rule, if you see that your mother may have entered into a financial transaction without telling you, better go to a lawyer and get him to investigate.
No, Your Honor. That's not at all what I'm saying. I'm just saying, under the particular facts here and the circumstances as set forth in the court's opinion.
I understand you want a circumstance, but I'm just saying, I just want to understand what the rule is in your view, because your brief is written that there were undisputed facts
that
made it clear that not only did they stop payment in 2000, but at the time, they possessed sufficient information and knowledge to support their belief that the loan was invalid and had been obtained under questionable circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we have yet to find a statement other than that they had concerns in the record. I don't want to belabor this anymore. Are there any other points you'd like to make?
No, Your Honor. I think I've, through the questioning, responded to the points that were made by the appellant. Unless there are any further questions, I will yield to my colleague.
Thank you.
I don't have any questions about jurisdiction.
Yeah. Would you like to submit on jurisdiction? I note that the parties have not cited a recent opinion of this court in April in Drain about 1653, but I think GEICO and Trans Insurance. So, unless there's some things you would like to point out to us on jurisdiction, you could submit on your brief.
Your Honor, I don't have anything further. I could give you a record cite for a question that was asked counsel earlier.
What is that?
A234 and 233. I'm sorry, 233 and 234. It's from a deposition transcript, and it talks about what the concerns were back in 1999 time frame, and with some particularity in page 55 of the deposition transcript talks about issues having to do with paperwork surrounding the loan and not having been privy to whatever had gone on. I was concerned. There is some more information in that portion.
I'll read it, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Cases. Oh, do we have anything else? No. Cases. Oh, sorry.
I'd just like to make a few points. It has never been the Hancock's position that they didn't have concerns in 1999. A transaction they didn't know about that their mother had entered became now their knowledge in 1999. But as Judge Rogers, as you mentioned, I think it was simply concerns.
Wasn't it concerns about the improprieties?
Well, if you, the one on page A397 is the response to one of the statements of undisputed facts, that the response of the Hancocks, and they deny that they stopped paying because of the questionable circumstances. They deny that allegation. They say the characterization continued to pay the loan is inaccurate, as the plaintiffs repeatedly went into default or for other reasons failed to pay the loan from 1998 onward.
Wait, say, repeat it again.
Sure.
Where did you disagree with this statement?
The first of all, it says denied. The statement is denied, and it's, I assume
Yes, but it's denied. What's the...
The characterization continued to pay the loan is inaccurate.
That's what you're denying, the continuing to pay the loan. You're not denying the impropriety, or the considerations.
But the rest of the sentence says, as the plaintiffs repeatedly went into default or for other reasons failed to pay the loan from 1998 onward. I don't think from that you can...
Well, wait a minute. You don't think the district judge could have legitimately concluded you were not disputing the assertion that you weren't paying the loan because of improprieties?
It doesn't say improprieties. It says allegedly questionable circumstances. Questionable, I mean, again, could mean, first of all...
So in other words, you agreed with the questionable circumstances?
I agreed that they had concerns and looked at this transaction...
And you agreed with questionable circumstances?
I don't agree with that. It says denied. It says denied here.
But then your explanation for the denial does not go to the questionable circumstances.
Except the last part says that we failed to pay the loan for other reasons. So I don't think you can draw from that statement that it's an admission to the fact that they stopped paying because they thought something was illegal. First of all, the question doesn't ask anything about did you think something was illegal?
Questionable circumstances would be enough, wouldn't it?
The full phrase is the characterization continued to pay the loan is inaccurate as plaintiffs repeatedly went into default or for other reasons failed to pay the loan from 98 onward.
I think it's an ambiguous statement. It's a denial in the first instance, and then it's an ambiguous statement as to what they're agreeing to. I don't think from that you can give a summary judgment in this situation, because if you add it to the depositions, the Hancocks stated they had concerns about this transaction because it occurred in a circumstance that they had no knowledge of. And because it occurred in Baltimore, and their mother may have gone there, but it was a concern to them because this had all happened without them having any knowledge. But they had no reason to think a forgery occurred, and if they had gone to a lawyer.
What about A425? I just want to try to parse that A425 to make sure I just want to make sure I'm understanding it correctly. For the initial 99, it says they became, this is number 25, they became troubled and had concerns about the loan. And then number 28 at the bottom of the page, it says, as of 2003, we're now talking about, they were again concerned about the proprieties of the loan documents. Do you think from that it's fair to assume that in 99 their concerns were about the proprieties of the loan documents?
I don't think you can categorically read it that way. I think this is a summary judgment and proprieties to the...
But this is a question of law.
As to what proprieties means?
Question of law as to whether this the judge properly concluded that this was an agreement to a statement of undisputed facts. That's not a factual issue. That's a question of law.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor.
You understand what I'm saying? We're reviewing the district judge's conclusion he draws from these documents.
Yes.
And that's a question of law.
I don't think from this document or any of the others, you can conclude that the Hancocks believed that a loan illegally occurred.
The question for us is whether or not the district judge could properly read this as a statement of undisputed facts, which is not disputed.
Yeah. I don't think you can properly read these two plus the one on the other page as an admission that they thought illegality had occurred.
Well, I have to say, counsel, if that's what was intended here by counsel for plaintiffs, it certainly was inartfully drawn.
Number 28, the word again is I think something that calls into the other one, but if you take the three of them together, the one on A397 and these two, I don't think it's sufficient for the district judge to have reached the single conclusion that the single conclusion that there was no dispute as to what.
Do you agree if it flat out said we were concerned about the proprieties of the loan documents as of 1999, then the district court's judgment was correct?
No, because the mere concern about the proprieties of the loan isn't enough to trigger the lawsuit. And for instance, I think the forgery is what really triggered the lawsuit. The knowledge that a forgery had occurred, and to look at these documents and say, my mother went to Baltimore, that seems a little bit fishy. She could have, but it seems fishy to me. Is this really a proper transaction if she couldn't really get to Baltimore? But unless a lawyer would then look at that and say, and it would trigger in the lawyer's mind, well, forgery probably occurred here. We ought to have a handwriting analysis. I don't think the lawsuit can be triggered in 1999. It was only in 2003 when those documents, other documents, different versions came to their attention that they said, no, wait a minute.
Those documents couldn't have been found in 99?
Well, that's not in the record. There's no testimony as to whether they could have or couldn't have been found in 1999. They were in a garage, apparently, by the house. But I don't think it's their, it shouldn't be their burden
that's
to have to find the documents.
Place, that's not the only place the documents exist, right?
Those documents that were in the garage may be the only place they exist, because those were the different, were different versions.
Right.
Okay. Maybe that she entered these, she was duped into signing these and thinking the whole transaction was final, and it wasn't the case. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement. We want to thank you, Mr. Shelley, for assisting the court.
Thank you.